Hi, folks. I hope this finds you safe and well. And, well, here we are, the first day of a new year. And I hope you are stepping into that with a kind of optimistic outlook. I hope I'm always a person, or I hope I strive to be a person who looks at situations with the attitude of the glass is half full as opposed to glass half empty. And I hope that you have found some kind of, I guess, escape through the conversations that I've been very lucky to have over the past almost year on this podcast in particular. Because I know for me, it's been an amazing opportunity to just escape and dive into the world of film and music, which is what I absolutely adore. So I hope that this podcast has given you some sense of joy, entertainment, and yeah, as I say, escapism. And we start a brand new year with another double header for you. It's been so wonderful because we've been inundated with people who want to be part of this and want to have a conversation. So we're very grateful to the time that people give us to have conversations. So today's double header then, first up, a true legend of recent cinema. Pete Docter is the Chief Creative Officer at Pixar. Now, as well as winning Oscars as the director of Inside Out and Up, he was one of the main reasons that we have Toy Story and has played some sort of hand in pretty much every movie to have come out of the studio. His latest project is the hugely ambitious Soul, which he both wrote and directed. It's streaming now on Disney Plus. The story follows a music teacher voiced by Jamie Foxx who seeks to reunite his soul and his body after they are accidentally separated just before his big break as a jazz musician. Soul, for me, is a phenomenal film and another great example of how Pixar just absolutely nail it when they approach their filmmaking and their storytelling. It appeals to so many levels of film fans. You know, we sat and watched it, three generations actually, my kids, ourselves, and my in-laws in our Christmas bubble. And everybody took something different away from this film. It is just extraordinary. The animation is beautiful and will surprise you in places. The music is very clever, as you'll hear in a second. But I just think that it's really clever, it's really fresh, it's really relevant, and it's really, really good. So as I said, it's available on Disney Plus now, so I'd highly recommend that you go and check it out. Then we have the fabulous Tessa Thompson talking about Sylvie's Love, another film to have jazz at its very core. It's a classic romance between Tessa's character, whose dad owns a record store, and a saxophonist that beautifully evokes the spirit of the age. Tessa's character in particular is phenomenal because she, being a woman of colour, very much strives in the 50s to achieve a brilliant career in TV, which is a kind of subtext to the story, but very important to the narrative in its own way and really interesting as well. It's available to watch now on Amazon Prime. Plenty more on that a little bit later, but we'll begin with Soul. Now, one of the interesting aspects of Soul is the score is provided by three composers. Jazzman John Batiste provides the music for the real-life New York segments of the film, while Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross bring their unique sensibilities to the metaphysical side of the narrative. And it's with one of John's cues that we start, Celestial Spaces in Blue.
How's it going?
Really good, thanks. How are you?
Good to see you. I'm well, all things considered.
Yeah, I know, isn't it? It's a brave new world that we find ourselves in.
Yes.
But listen, thank you for this film, for giving us the gift of Soul, because my God, we need anything at the minute. And this is just so many wonderful things. So thank you so much.
Oh, good. I'm glad you liked it.
I'm really interested to find out what the seed of this idea was, because our podcast soundtracking is all about the relationship with music. And if you look at the films that you've both written and directed over the years, music has got such a powerful place within those, and the themes that Randy or Michael have created. But music is very much part of the narrative with this as well. What was the seed? Where did the idea come from for Soul?
Yeah, there's a lot of, I mean, the soundtrack is...
I like how you're rubbing your hands
Soundtrack is essential to the whole movie in this case, you know, going way back to the idea of incorporating jazz. And the idea, I think it was this story we heard that the great pianist Herbie Hancock told about playing with Miles Davis. And feeling as though he screwed up by playing the wrong chord at this concert. He said, "We were having a great tour, and then I played this chord, and it was so wrong." He thought he ruined the whole night. But he said, Miles just looked at him, took a breath, and played some notes and made the chord seem like it was the right thing. And he said, "How did he do that? It took me years to figure that out." He says, "Miles didn't judge what had happened. He just did what any great jazz musician should do, which is to take anything that happens and turn it into something of value." And we're like, whoa, that is the movie, right? That's what we're trying to say in the movie. So jazz as a metaphor, that was one of the first like real strong pillars of the theme as we went forward. So jazz was essential. We got to work with John Batiste, who's a brilliant jazz pianist, also the band leader on the Stephen Colbert's show. And then we wanted, and I knew early on, though I love the work of Randy and Michael and all the folks we've worked with, we wanted this film to really feel different, to have a different kind of thumbprint on it. I had been lucky enough to work with Ren Kleiss, who is a sound designer. He did the sound design on Inside Out. He also, incidentally, worked on, I think, all of David Fincher's films and had worked with Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross. And so even though it seemed very unlikely, we talked through Ren about possibly working together. And they said, well, it's a little scary, but it sounds intriguing. And we were like, yeah, it's a little out of our box, too. I don't know if this is going to work.
Let's do it.
Yeah.
That's what's great about it. I think is when you look at them as a, you know, in terms of the work, the fantastic work they've done and what they are providing us sonically with at the minute, and the two ends of what they do, you know, Mank and Soul, and it's kind of, it's extraordinary. But you have to make those, there's so many kind of important elements to weave together. You know, you have, you know, with Jonathan's beautiful kind of compositions, but then also the work that they've done as well, and then and making it really fit the story as well, so that it doesn't feel clunky or unnecessary. And you have this brilliant way as well where you've almost created sounds and types of music almost for different areas. I'm trying to remember what the name of the place is. It's the Before Life.
Yeah, the Great Before.
The Great Before, yeah. And so that has this great kind of almost electronic vibe to it that's just really lovely, and almost by the sounds you know where you are.
Thank you.
Yeah, and that was part of the design from the beginning. So we asked Trent Atticus to really give us music to represent the sort of ethereal nature of what soul is. And then John Batiste gave us the more like grounded, gritty, earth-based music that also is soul. And then part of the thing that, well, it's really inherent in, and they were very open about this, that Trent and Atticus, they say, look, the music we give you is not just played out of the speakers. It's part of the immersion. You feel like you're in the middle of it, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that's absolutely true. And so, you know, the way they partner with Ryan Kleiss so that he is bringing his sound design in just the right way that's not redundant or stepping on the toes of the music. It's all a carefully choreographed dance.
Mm. It looks beautiful as well. The film is so, it feels like it has the kind of ethos of jazz to it in terms of when you think of the way that you've animated. And there are moments where it's almost kind of freestyling in a way. And it's really, really gorgeous and really just exciting to watch. Was that a kind of marriage that you deliberately kind of made or reference you kind of made?
Yeah, because jazz seems to come with its own visual design. You know, a lot of album covers, they're
cool.
Really cool, yeah, colorful and stark and crisp and so on. And so that was designed purposely for New York to be like that, whereas the soul world is much more soft and curvy and so on. And so, you know, the two worlds oppose each other in the same way as we were talking about the two kind of definitions of the way you think about soul.
Yeah.
You know, on the one hand, it's like the highest kind of abstraction of who we are, the center of without our skin and bones, you know, the sort of spiritual sense. And then it's also like if you think of soul music or soul food, it's like gritty and getting your fingers dirty kind of feel. So it's got both of those. And I think we try to reflect that in the design.
You have this amazing ability with your films and the screenplays that you write that they appeal to so many generations, so many ages of people. You know, I've lost count of how many times as a family, you know, I've got two boys who are now 7 and 12, and the amount of times that we've watched Up and Inside Out again and again and again, and every time we sit down to watch it, it's like watching it for the first time. It has us immediately, and we all take something away from it, and almost it facilitates us as film fans for different things, for different ways we're feeling. You know, it's like a comfort blanket almost in a way as well, and a kind of friend. And this is another extension of that. You know, my kids, they within 20, and they're kind of bouncing off the walls at the minute, you know, with everything going on. And yeah. We put them down in front of Soul, and you have them in the palm of your hand within, like, you know, the first beat, basically. How do you do it? Because you just write the most incredibly, they seem so simple to watch and to look at, but there's so much depth to them, these stories.
Well, that is so cool to hear, because it is a lot of work, frankly, and it's a lot of being wrong over and over, and trying to correct and second guess ourselves, and, you know, put ourselves in the audience's shoes. And, you know, we have this is no secret, we have a process that we storyboard So we draw everything. So this is long before we've shot anything. We haven't built the sets and characters and things. But we draw the whole thing up. We put it on video with temporary music and our own dialogue that we just do by ourselves and sound effects. And in that way, we can sit in the theater and pretend like, okay, this is the final movie. We even go so far as to put the little castle logo in the lamp at the beginning just to convince ourselves it's real. Okay, pretend it's real. And then we watch it and we go up into a room and we talk with our fellow filmmakers about what was it that worked and what didn't.
Mm-hmm.
So by the time you see the movie, we've basically made it 7 or 8 times.
Wow.
Before we actually make it for real, you know.
Over what space of time? For Soul, for example, how long has that been in the making?
Soul was about 4 years from concept to finish. Inside Out was 5. We lost a year on this one. So, you know, the actual making of it, like if somehow the absolute perfect script could come like, oh, down from heaven, we could probably make that in about 14 months, a little more than a year.
That's how we think it arrives to you, because for us as film fans, that's what it's like. It's like, ah, here's another peak film.
No, it's a big mess. And the lion's share of the work that we do is, you know, trying to make that thing work.
Yeah. How about the casting? How early are you, you know, when you're writing this, are you thinking about actors? Are you thinking about voices for these characters and stuff? Because Jamie's just can't think of anybody else in this role. And even when you think back to the other films that you've written that you didn't necessarily direct, whether it's, you know, Toy Story, the original Toy Story, and those voices and those actors that took on those roles that have become so iconic. Do you write with actors in mind?
At very first, usually not. In fact, well, sometimes, like I was thinking back on Up, we were writing with, what's his name? A different actor who's long deceased. Now, I can't, he's blocked on his name. Anyway, what usually happens is we start by being kind of blue sky, and then at some point, we start thinking about casting. We work with the actor, and then they inform the role, right? So we listen to them and are like, oh, this line doesn't work. Why is it? Well, this word doesn't seem natural, or the rhythm that we've written is wrong. So we learn from the actors. We go back and rewrite everything. And so they really become a very integral part of the writing process without really even trying. It's just we try to write for and to the actor.
I mean, I love Graham Norton in this as well as Moon.
Oh, yeah. He's fantastic, isn't he?
It's really, really good. Yeah. And my kids absolutely love Richard Ayoade, so they're like, it's Richard Ayoade! They're so excited to hear his voice. It's kind
of both of those guys gave us so much to hang our hats on. Not only from animation, because of course when you're listening, an animator, we record the voices first. So the animators, I'm jumping all over the place, getting so excited.
Good,
okay, so we record the actors, and then out of the 40 or whatever takes that we have. And most of the time we don't have that many, but Richard specifically would give us all sorts of wonderful improvisations and things that we weren't expecting. And so we had the tough choices of these 5 lines are all great. Which one can we use? So then we select those, we give those to the animators, and they listen and create the performance that you see based on what you hear. And now I've forgotten what it was you asked, but it was a fun process. They were both such great collaborators on this.
What was, just going back to Atticus and Trent, what was their, were they kind of really excited about the idea of the project? Because like you said, it is kind of not what you'd expect them to do when you kind of look at, you know, the composer and soundtrack world that they're used to being in. And I think they've done an amazing job. But what was their, were they really excited about the idea of kind of not surprising people, but, you know, kind of, I guess, stepping out the expected?
I think they were nervous at the beginning. And, you know, to be honest, we were too. We were like, okay, the Girl with the Dragon Tattoo is great. But if we put that on, kids are going to run screaming out of the theater, you know. How is this going to work?
Gone Girl.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it was fun, though, because we brought them in. We showed them one of these storyboard versions of the film. And I was really nervous because, you know, some people have trouble seeing through these crude drawings to understanding what the film is about. So I was like, I know it's still rough and you might not, if you need me to explain. And they're like, we're kind of blown away. The film really spoke to them. Trent specifically said he has been through the same thing I have, where you feel like once I reach this abstract peak, whatever that is that you define for yourself, that everything in my life is going to figure itself out and it's all going to be perfect. And he said, you know, he told a great story of having played his first stadium show and feeling like, I've made it. And then realizing, wait, everybody at the end of that went home to their own lives and I'm the same guy, you know? Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so that's really central to the film that we're talking about. So it really spoke to them. And I knew as soon as that happened that we were on really solid ground, because I think for any artist, they need to be able to internalize and feel what it is they're talking about. So that was a real win that day. I felt like, okay, we're off to a good start. They worked. Yeah, they're very different. So in the way we work with, say, Michael Giacchino or Mr. Newman, you know, they typically will bring them in along the way just to show them what we're doing. But we don't give them the work until we're almost to a frame, picture locked. You know, we know exactly what's happening, and then they write a score. In the case of Trent and Atticus, they started feeding us options and ideas along the way. So the scene is still being written and they're like, here's five different ideas for what this scene, the music could be. And we'd go, ooh, this one is really cool, but let's use this other one over here. You know, so it was much more of a, I guess you'd say, an organic process.
Yeah.
Of iteration and kind of working around in the same way we work on the films. The music became part of that as well.
Amazing. Listen, we've run out of time, Pete, but I hope we get the chance at some point in the future to kind of really deep dive into soundtracks and the rest of the brilliant films that you've worked on. But huge congratulations on Soul.
I can't
wait to watch it again.
Oh, good. That's a good sign.
Yeah. take care and massive congratulations. Merry Christmas.
Oh, thank you.
From the score to Soul, that's 22 Is Ready by Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross, rounding off the first part of our New Year's Day soundtrack and with the wonderful Pete Docter. Now, I should say that, fingers crossed, it looks like we have got time with Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross, and we'll be talking about Soul as well as Mank and many, many other things, because their kind of CV of composing is extraordinary. And Pete Docter, what a properly lovely fella he is, and well, just a little bit talented too. I really hope to have the opportunity to have a bit more time with Pete in the future to really delve into his historic story with Pixar and his brilliant and beautiful filmmaking. And as I mentioned, you can watch Soul on Disney Plus, and you don't need any reminder as to how much I loved it. And so to the phenomenal and hugely talented Tessa Thompson and her new film Sylvie's Love. Sylvie's Love is scored by Fabrice Lecomte, and we'll kick off with one of his compositions from the movie First Encounter. Thank you. Hey Tessa, welcome back to Soundtrack, and thank you so much for coming on to talk about Sylvie's Love.
So I loved it. I mean, this is a film that you're kind of fully immersed in as well, in terms of your kind of roles behind the camera as well as in front of, you know, in terms of being an exec producer on it and stuff. How does that change things for you in terms of your involvement in a film?
Yeah, well, you know, I don't know. I think for me, producing felt like a natural extension of the way I work in general. I typically am really hands-on. I know some actors that kind of come to set and they're very focused on just their contribution, but and I've always envied that, actually, because it's easier to sort of concentrate on just what you have to do, but I've never been very good at that. I'm always like curious and interested in meddling in everyone else's job, because I like the process of storytelling, and to me it's all one. So it feels like a natural extension. I will say a difference that I really enjoy is that I feel like when I look at the film, I feel like my contribution is inside of the DNA of the project. So if you look at Sylvie's Love, there are shots in it that I suggested. There is a whole sequence that I pitched to Eugene and to Namdi, my fellow producer. And so I get to see it, and it is a different, it's a different connection that I have to the process when I feel like I'm instrumental in the way that the thing is made from the ground up, and I just enjoy it so much.
Well, it's that investment in the character as well on a whole other level, isn't it, almost, in a way?
Yeah, exactly. And I also love just the teamwork aspect of it and getting to really get in there and work very closely with everyone, because, you know, obviously for this film, Namdi and I are on screen, but there's a host of people that make the story possible. And I really love being able to feel closer connected to that collective of artists and storytellers.
Music has an amazing place within this film on so many different ways. You know, there's an amazing thread of music that we hear throughout the film. There's Sylvie's kind of almost encyclopedic knowledge on music that I love hearing. The record store, just, it's beautiful. It kind of like, it almost has this wonderful multifaceted kind of role within the film. You know, music, it's kind of not just one thing. It plays so many parts within the film. Was that in the script? Was that kind of really obvious that was kind of how it was going to be with Eugene's script, that music was not just a case of there's going to be songs here and we're going to watch, you know, Namdi play here, but it had a more of a more purpose, really.
Yeah, there was that was always embedded in the script, which was a reason why I was really compelled to make it. My father's a musician. I grew up, like, you know, going through vinyl, much like Sylvie, although we didn't have a record shop. I like grew up around a lot of music and varied influences. So music is always a language that I feel like I've spoken. And Eugene comes from the world of music, was a recording artist. And so it was a huge part of his story, you know, inside of a story about, you know, romantic love between these two characters. There's also the kind of love that is shared with people that you make things with in this form of this band, and all the ups and downs and trials and tribulations of that kind of love. Mm-hmm. So the love of music was always embedded into this piece.
It's that thing as well with relationships, isn't it, where you always have music plays such an important part, whether that's at the start of a relationship where you're kind of picking tunes can almost tell you a lot about a person, can't it?
Yeah. I know, it's like that thing of when you're sending songs back and forth and you can like read between the lines and thinking of someone's trying to tell you something with music. I love that. I still love that. I'm like a kid in high school or something.
And also when you play certain songs at certain times in your life where you need almost like a support, whether that's a kind of emotional support where you deliberately will go to a song that you know is going to provide exactly what you need.
Yeah, trust me, this year has been a tough one. So there's a lot of music assisting me through a day or an hour or a moment, definitely.
Am I right in thinking that Namdi learned to play sax for this?
He did, yeah. He had played the clarinet growing up a little bit, but not hugely. And he spent about a year learning. So when we first started having conversations about this, the, you know, doing this piece. I think he had already begun. You know, it's so hard to get out because our film is independent now. We're so lucky it's going to stream on Amazon, but we made it as an independent film. And there's this period where you think it's going to happen. It almost happens. It doesn't happen. And he didn't want to waste any time. And so as soon as he thought, I'd really like to make this movie, he began learning how to play saxophone so that if and when the movie happened, he'd be ready. And, you know, it's actually a testament to him. My dad, who's a musician and started on the alto sax, I think it was my dad was alto. He was really impressed by Namdi and the way he looked playing. So I actually haven't told Namdi that. I should tell him that.
That's lovely.
I think it was quite easy to fall in love with Namdi as a performer because I really, he was working so hard. And I think work ethic is something that I really admire in other performers. And just when you care so much about a thing and you're working really hard to try to do a story justice. And that was something that he was really doing that I just was so taken by. And he was also falling in love with film because it's only a second time.
You know. Crazy.
Making a movie. So it was really, I felt really swept away by getting to watch someone very early on in their career, you know, just, yeah, fall in love with the process of making a film.
He has such a tender relationship with the sax, you know, in terms of, you can see the way that, that Sylvie is, she falls in love with him, but she does also fall in love in terms of the way that he treats his musical instrument in a way as well. It's so beautiful. Even the way that she says, "You're going to be the next John Coltrane." And I love that line. And I love the way that you say it to him as well. So tender and beautiful.
It's really tender. I will say that's a space that I can relate to in terms of Sylvie. I've always liked musicians. I've always found
I'm married to one.
I've always found it pretty easy to fall for somebody that's very, very good at making music. And
why is that?
Yeah, I don't know. The process of watching them on stage do what they do, I definitely, you know, I understand that. I really understand that.
But it's kind of nice as well because I guess the shoe was on the other foot with like Bianca, you know, in terms of you playing a musician as well. That was a gorgeous role. You fitted that role of a musician so beautifully. And maybe that's from growing up with your father being a musician and watching, you know, how a musician is and the relationship they have with the instrument.
Yeah, I think so. It was like a lot of, you know, just from my father and also just a lot of my friends. And again, you know, like people that I've gotten to know. So I've spent a lot of time in studios and also secretly I had this sort of secret love. I would make music and I wouldn't let anyone hear it. That was before I played Bianca. And I sang in a band for a while. Music was always like a second love. Never something that I wanted to pursue seriously, but was always a part of my identity. And so with Bianca, I had the chance to really write music and put it out into the world with some barrier between me and it, because I was doing it in service of a character. And I feel really lucky. I love playing that character and love getting to write music. And thankfully I get to do it again because we'll make another Creed. So it's a really joyful outlet for me.
Take it all. try to run, but just to make you follow. I like it when you grip, 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 grip me. Got you right where I want. I can see it all. Don't hold back, keep coming. No, I don't wanna stop. I like it when you grip.
What do you love about writing music?
I think I love, well, particularly the way that we wrote on the first Creed was we just locked ourselves, me and the composer and producer, Ludwig Göransson, we just locked ourselves in the studio. He's also like...
He's amazing.
He's nuts. He's so incredibly talented. So to get to work with somebody like him who's so skilled and so genius. And I think something that was fun for me is we were writing on the fly and we'd have musicians come in, really incredible musicians from Moses Sumney to Childish Gambino, to Sam Du, Bebe Borelli, all these incredible,
wow.
James Fauntleroy, like giants, you know, like just incredible folks come in and would be writing with them in real time. And the truth is, cause I'm like the newbie in the room. I'm not the musician. It's not necessarily my comfort zone. I think I really enjoy just the process of taking those leaps and doing things that scare me and being able to do that inside of music. And then I think just music for me feels like the most universal way that we can connect. You don't have to be from the same place or speak the same language, but you can get inside of a sonic experience. Mm-hmm. And I think that I just love the ways in which music really brings people together. And certainly cinema does that, and so do the fine arts in a way, but I feel like music does that in a way that is so universal and immediate. You just can't beat it. It's just the most, I think it's the most sort of primal human, visceral way to connect people.
Breathe the hand that holds the heart that holds me down. Breathe the feeling that we had is nowhere now.
I think that's one of the things I've missed the most about the world of COVID is watching live music.
Yeah, me too.
Having that kind of, like you say, like a room of people that you don't know, but you're all having this amazing communal sort of physical experience together.
Yeah,
it's really special.
I really miss that. And certainly for so many of my, you know, friends and even family members that had plans to tour this year, I know it's been really hard to understand how to pivot during this time. And so I'm hopeful that we can start doing that again safely, you know, next year.
I've got to thank you as well for taking part in James and the Giant Peach, which me and my two boys were obsessing over. Like, is there another chapter up? It was the best thing ever during lockdown. It was so special. It was so great.
Oh, I'm so happy to hear that. Yeah, it was so fun to do. And I loved that book and that story growing up as a kid. So it felt really nostalgic and special. And this has been such a hard time. I like, my hat's off to parents during this time, because it's been so much to have children, young children, to try to keep them safe, sound, and also have any time to yourself. So I like the idea of being able to create something during this time that, you know, hopefully brought some joy and some respite to families.
I think my 12-year-old and I have watched Thor Ragnarok 3 times during lockdown. And Valkyrie's a real rock star, though. She's a real kind of I could see her on stage completely rocking out, you know, in terms of having her own band. She would be, because the way Taika surrounded her with music as well in the film, I think it almost accentuated that as well.
Yeah, so Taika's a huge music fan, and thankfully he and I have a lot of the same taste in music. We're big David Bowie fans, and he plays tons of music on set. There's music constantly when we're making that film. And also music is just a big part of his process. So even in the draft of For Now, he'll talk about what music he is imagining played. And it's a big part of, you know, the energy of the scene is this idea of music. And it's really fun working with someone that works that way, because that's the way that I work too. I use music so much in charting a character and trying to find energy. So it's really fun to get to do that with Taika.
Amazing. Listen, it's so exciting because there's so much that we have to enjoy you in and look forward to. And Sylvie's Love is just a really, it's a beautiful film. And also just in terms of a soundtrack of songs to listen to, you know, if you listen to all the music that features in the film, it is the most beautiful compilation of music.
Yeah, it's a really special one. It was really fun to get to listen to all this music during the time. And again, actually similar to Taika, Eugene Ash had a lot of that music embedded into the script. And so I feel really lucky that we were able to actually get that music and have it be a part of the project, because it certainly felt so instrumental in the crafting of it.
Well, listen, we run out of time, but thank you so much for your time. And maybe we can chat again around Love and Thunder and talk about Valkyrie the rock star.
I would love that. Thanks, you.
You take care. Stay safe, Tessa. Thank you, love. Bye-bye.
From the score to Sylvie's Love, that's First Kiss by Fabrice Leconte, which brings us to the end of 2021's first episode of our film music podcast with Tessa Thompson and, of course, Pete Docter. My huge thanks to both Tessa and Pete for taking the time to talk to us. Sylvie's Love is streaming now on Amazon Prime with Soul on Disney+. Now, there are playlists for both of our guests on our Spotify page featuring the cues we gave you a little flavour of in the order they appear. Head to edithbowman.com meanwhile to catch up with all of our previous episodes, including my first chat with Tessa and lovely conversation with Pixar stalwarts Lee Unkrich and Dan Scanlon. You can follow us on Facebook, Instagram and Twitter. We are at Soundtracking UK. And please do look up our YouTube channel too for a companion piece to this podcast that I put together when I can. In fact, in the next couple of days, I'm going to stick up the full conversation that I had with Tessa so you can see her in her beauty and enthusiasm visually. So do go and check that out, as I said, on YouTube. We'll be back next week with more conversation around music and film. I very much look forward to the pleasure of your company then.